Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's the king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
And we're live. Hey, Demetrius, wake up. Demetrius, wake up.
What's that?
Yeah.
Good morning, Nate.
Rob, Mr. Grumpy.
Morning. Morning, fellas. No, I'm not grumpy today. I'm not at all.
Well, you're grumpy when I called you the first time.
I've been going to that prolotherapist over there in Minneapolis. And he got rid of all my grumpiness because I don't have any neck pain anymore, so I can actually play some pool.
Well, great, Rob. I'm glad to hear that. And we have a pretty big podcast planned for today, so we should probably get started. We can start with getting all the stuff in the beginning cleared up. So we'll start with a Patreon update. This week we have another new Patreon subscriber, so thank you very much to Brent Ishman. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If I'm not, sorry. You can write me back and yell at me for pronouncing it wrong, but I think that's right. So when you become a subscriber to the Patreon system, not only do you get stuff right away, so Brent actually gets a t-shirt and a patch, you also get entered into our going to be coming up raffles, and they're going to be completely random based off of the tier that you join. So each tier will give you a different amount of entries, and the entries can have you win things like McDermott has decided that they are going to donate a knit hat, some Ultimate Team Gear jerseys, some t-shirts, a game room gear bundle, which is just a bunch of like things that you would have if you had like a bar in your home, some shot glasses, some, you know, stuff like that, a shaft maintenance kit, a jump cue, and a left-handed billiard glove. And the left-handed billiard glove is actually the same glove that I use. It's, in my opinion, the best glove that you can get out there on the market that I've tried, at least. They're sensational gloves. I really, really like them. Q-Tech has not told me exactly what they are going to be donating yet, but it's probably going to consist of a variety of jerseys, gloves, and tip tools. So very practical things, obviously, if you're a pool player. Jacoby Custom Qs has donated two gift baskets, which will be in my possession in a couple weeks. Billiard Factory also has not said exactly what they will be contributing, but they are going to contribute something. And it might be some billiard balls, it might be some tip tools, maybe a carbon fiber shaft. We haven't exactly came up with that yet, but they will be donating something. And then the grand prize for it will actually be a $250 gift card towards a JB custom case. So how this is going to work is sometime in very early March, I am going to basically, at that point in time, I'm going to take a look at all of the Patreon subscribers that I have to the podcast. And if there are only six, then there are only six. And probably every single week, I will do another drawing for one random winner of all of the Patreon subscribers. And how many entries you get will actually be dependent on which of the tiers you are in. So somebody who is in a higher tier will get more entries, of course, than somebody who is in a lower tier. And that just seems to be the fairest way to do it. So once a week on podcast, I will actually randomly draw one of those people. And that person will be the winner for that week. And I will get in contact with that person. And then they will be able to pick any of the prizes within a certain confinement of the prizes that I have available, and they can just choose whatever they want. The bigger prizes will not be in those. Those will be different drawings, like the jump cue or the set of balls, or obviously the JB custom gift certificate. Most of the rest of the prizes, you'll just get to pick whatever you want from any of them, and I will send them to you pretty much immediately. So that will just be kind of a thank you to anybody who is really taking the future of the podcast seriously, and kind of backing up their support of the podcast with being a Patreon subscriber. So it's a big thank you to a lot of the people who are helping the future of the podcast. In the coming weeks, I will have a better idea on what actually all of the prizes are. And I will make probably a post on Facebook, and all of the prizes will be clearly made visible to whoever wins, so they'll be able to pick, and we'll actually get you out onto the Facebook page with who you are and what your prize was. So I guess with that, I can talk a little bit more about the actual tiers themselves. So there are actually four tiers for the Patreon. There is a fan tier, a contributor tier, a supporter tier, and then an executive supporter tier. The JB Custom Case gift card will only be for the contributor, supporter, and executive supporter tiers for the Patreon support. On top of what you get for that already being part of that tier, you will have entry into winning a $250 gift certificate towards a custom case. So each of these tiers also has different perks in them already. They're a thank you from the podcast towards the ongoing support of the podcast in the future. And if we're going to make the podcast as big as I envision it being, or, you know, as cover as many things as I would like to cover, I'm not going to be able to do it on my own. It's going to have to be a support thing from the community. So that's why the Patreon has been set up. And yes, so if you have been looking for a reason to join the Patreon system, there should be plenty of things given away in the very near future that you could win just by supporting the podcast going forward. So head over to Patreon if you so choose and get signed up for one of the tiers. And thank you, and thank you for ongoing support for anybody who chooses to do this. So we can move on from that. I have been giving regular updates over the past, I guess, couple episodes about the sharing of the podcast. I'm not going to do that again, but I have still been monitoring them, and the contest goes for another 10 days. So if you have not gotten over and shared anything and you want to, you are starting to run out of time, but there's still plenty of time. So first place, of course, every single time that you share the podcast, you will be entered in one time unless you share the page itself. If you share the page itself, you get two entries. And there have been a couple of people that have actually done that in the recent weeks. So I thank you for that. I think that's the best way of getting the page out there for the new people. So I have been monitoring that. And at the end of the month, I will do a drawing of live Facebook feed, where I do an actual drawing for the winners of the Moscone Cup magazine, which is signed by all of the U.S. players, and a t-shirt and a patch. So head over there and share anything on the Facebook page. And besides that, we can move on. Now we can move on to our shout-outs for the podcast. So, Demi, would you like to go first with your shout-out?
Yes, I would like to shout-out to my friend, Mol Bashir. He lives in my metro area, and he is actually, well, I don't know what to tell you about Mo. He's a big, you know, he's a passionate pool player. He's one of those guys that just, you'd feel like the pool community wasn't complete without him. He goes to the tournaments, he plays leagues, he's at the pool hall hitting balls and practicing. He's always enthusiastic to see you. In particular with me, he's the one that was kind of prompting me to kind of do this and get more into pool training and pool coaching. And he's been extremely supportive of everything I've done, both professionally and, you know, both by giving me really great feedback about how much I've helped him, which encouraged me to continue, as well as supporting me as I've moved forward and done this full time. So I was thinking about it. I can't tell you enough. This guy's done so much for me. So Mo, thank you very much for everything.
All right, Rob, do you want to go second?
I'm going to shout out to a local player. He's probably pushing into the A division in Wisconsin, maybe this year. So he's basically a beginner player, but he's started to organize different, like every other Friday night tournament in some of the bars in my area. And he is the type of character that pool needs. Our sport needs the player that wants to get better, that wants to learn and willing to, you know, put his time in to learn how to play. He's not no intention of becoming a professional player, but he just wants to get better at the sport. So, Ben Stroysma, I'm going to shout out to you for that attitude.
All right. I will give my shout out this week to Michael Salmon. And Michael Salmon is a – He was actually the very first Patreon supporter to the podcast, so thank you for that. As well as when the tournament was going on at Hard Times this past weekend, he was giving me some regular updates on some gambling matches that were happening before and, you know, all of the storylines on the way through and lots of drama and all that good stuff. And you know what I'm talking about. So I will give a shout out to Michael for being one of the big supporters of the podcast from the beginning and sticking with us. So with that, we can jump into the podcast. So there wasn't a ton that happened this past weekend. The big event was the Texas Open, which, Rob, you are so excited to talk about this, aren't you?
Skinny Bob's. You ever been there?
I have not.
Skinny Bob's, home of the Texas Open.
Yep.
No, I haven't either.
Yep. And boy, was it, if you wanted to do well at the Texas Open, you didn't want to be from Texas. It seemed like you wanted to be from the Philippines. The Philippines absolutely just destroyed this tournament. First place goes to Dennis Arcoya, who wins in completely dominating fashion, winning 7-0 over Warren Kiamko. Third place goes to Francisco Bustamante, another Filipino. So all the top three are Filipinos. Fourth place goes to, and it just says Strop. Now, Demi, maybe you'd know better than I do, but I don't know who Strop is.
Yeah, not offhand. Maybe I'm missing something obvious here, but
yeah, it just says Strop, and he must be a pretty good player because he beat some really, really top players. So fourth place goes to Strop. Fifth, sixth goes to Nayuki Oi and Roberto Gomez, another Filipino. Seventh, eighth goes to Josh Roberts and Junior Juinko. And then ninth through 12th goes to Jean Salim, Sergio Rivas, a Wisconsin guy, Jeffrey DeLuna, and Sky Woodward. So another Filipino in there. And then 13th through 16th, just for good measure, is Rudy Sanchez, Kevin Guimond, Brian Sanders, and James Aranis, another Filipino. So definitely seems to be the Filipino Open.
Yeah, that's quite a display. You know, of course, well, Dennis has been kind of on the tear here.
Dennis has been playing really good.
Yeah. I wonder what it's really interesting to me to see. You know, we all know that there's a handful of people in the world that are kind of like live to win any tournament they play and big pre-tournament favorites. But that doesn't mean that they don't have good and bad streaks. And, you know, what do you think that's, you know, it seems like right now, you know, some of it's a little bit of luck of the draw. You know, you get a good bracket or a few things go your way. But there's a lot of this game that's obviously just feeling good, hitting them good. I mean, good. I don't know, man. I just Dennis must be playing really, really well. And what's really nice to see is a 10-ball event because we know that he plays great games, but we also know that playing 10-ball, his break has been effective, but it's never been good enough to where he can actually, like, win these long races to 100. And as these younger guys come on, like Clenty Kotchew ran that 8-pack on Alex a year or two ago, and, you know, all these guys have this breakdown where they're all just running so many racks. It's nice to see Dennis. I think Dennis has both worked on his break a little bit, and at the same time, he's just such a good after-the-break player that as long as he's worked on his break enough to where it's not a prohibitive leak, it's just – he's live to win against anybody. And so I've seen him put in some work on his break. I know that even when he played Shane, that race to 100 here about 6 months ago, I know he'd put in a bunch of work on his break trying to get ready. Wasn't enough to beat the Shane train, but I'll tell you, I'm excited that he did that because it's nice to see him put himself in a position to win these things like so decisively.
For sure. And he won in dominating fashion from basically start to finish. So first round, he played Kenny Loftus. I'm not totally sure who that is, but he wins 7-4. Second match, he plays John Gabriel, wins 7-1. Then he plays Justin Hall, 7-3. Kevin Guimond, who ended up taking, you know, pretty high up in the – I mentioned his name in the places. He wins 7-3. And then he plays Junior Juco, 7-1. And then he plays Nayuki Oi, 7-2. And then he beats Warren Kiamko for the chair 7-6 and then wins in the final 7-0. That is, he got to the hill once, and the highest anybody else got besides that was, you know, to yeah.
What was the cumulative score? So how many matches did he play, and how many games did he give up? So he won 7 games. How many times? How many matches?
He lost a total of 20 games, and he won. So he won 56 games and lost 20. Yeah. Pretty good against professional players. 20.
Yeah, and you know what, man? I'll tell you, and you guys know this, but what I mean, I think the break is I just keep coming back to it because I know that this story that we just witnessed here, you know, people see this, if they see it as a snapshot, like a standalone event, they're just like, oh, the message here is that Dennis is just a transcendent player, that when he's on it for a weekend, then he could just do this. But I know, I don't know, maybe I'm projecting a little bit, maybe I don't know, but I think I know what Dennis has gone through, which is that he has been one of the best players in the world for, I don't know, 15 years or more. And that when the game went to 10 ball and when Shane came out and some guys like Shane developed that break, all of a sudden it's in the formats have been such that, you know, sometimes it's because the break, and Dennis didn't have the break that these guys had for 10 ball. He just didn't. I mean, even when he played Shane, it was a decisive difference, and I think we all know it. So it's how frustrating is it? Let me just ask you this question. How frustrating is it to develop your skills to where you are the best after-the-break player in the world, and you can shoot carom shots, you know, you can pocketing balls, caroms, cue ball control, pattern play, mental game, confidence, heart, stamina, feel, speed control, creativity, and striking and safeties. You are the best in the world at every one of those things. And yet, you show up and get drummed out of tournament after tournament after tournament by Eurobots that break and plant the ball better than you do. How frustrated are you? Let me ask you that. If you've been the best after-the-break player in the world for 15 years and you can't win because you can't hit this one trick shot hard, how frustrating would that be?
I'd work hard on it.
So
yeah, well,
I'd devote all my time to a break.
Yeah, and that is part of the game, right? Is it has to come down to you have to work on every single facet of your game, and all the top players in the world right now, for the most part, have a big break, and it's kind of a separating factor between a lot of players at this point. Dennis is so ultra talented at every single other facet of the game that. Even without having a top break,
you see the same thing.
Yeah, and so there's something, and I'll tell you guys, because I've been through this, and I know it not nearly to the level Dennis has, but I've gone through that too, where I played very, very good after the break, but I grew up playing amateur players where they would hand me opportunities, and I didn't need to have a crushing break because people would just hang balls or kick and miss, and I'd get enough opportunities to where I just ran out the balls good, and I generally end up winning. When I started playing to where I had to have a big break, I didn't have that skill, and I tried to develop it. And I will tell you this, it's for anybody that's listening, it sounds, you could dismiss it. It's like, oh, well, just practice your break, just get better at breaking. Yeah. And it's like, well, what if you can't? What if you spent an hour a day, an hour and a half a day breaking into a break rack 150 times? What if you've racked the balls and racked the balls and racked the balls, and you spent 5, 10, 15 hours a week monotonously slamming into break racks, working with coaches and videotape? And what if you've done that not for 6 months or for a year, but what if you've done that for 10 years? And you just, for whatever reason, it's a timing shot, it's a body movement, it's a swing, it's a sighting, for whatever reason, you're just not able to get there. And then that limits your career to the point where instead of being the most dominant player of the decade, you're just kind of a name that could have a flash in the pan once in a while. I'll tell you, it is working on your break. There's wisdom there because for sure it speaks to improvement, which is if you want to improve, then you have to be realistic about identifying what's holding you back. And then you've got to be determined and committed, and you've got to devote your resources to that. So whether you can succeed or not, you have to identify it correctly and you have to prioritize it correctly. But I'll tell you, if Dennis could, you know, if Dennis could have Shane break for him, nobody in the world could beat him playing 10 ball. And it is not because he doesn't understand that. I mean, it's not that Dennis doesn't understand that. It's not that he hasn't identified that. It's not that he hasn't prioritized that. It's just that not everybody can do everything. Otherwise, I would say that to everybody. It's like, well, what's the answer? We'll just practice till you're the best in the world at everything. Well, it's easy to say, but not easy to do. And so anyway, for all this, it's got to be extremely frustrating for Dennis. And I don't think people really understand how frustrating for Dennis that is. And that's why when he plays things like Derby, it's got to be so exciting to him to where he's like, I'm playing Banks. I'm playing One Pocket. I'm playing Nine Ball. I'm playing games where playing an all around where it's not just going to come down to one break.
Yep.
Yeah. And so he's like, well, let's take the break out of it and see how good you guys play. And all of a sudden he starts popping off all arounds and all this. So, but all that being said, here's a flat out 10 ball tournament. And I'm just really, the reason I've been ranting about this, I'm really excited that he has developed his break to the point where it may not be the best in the world, but it's at least competitive enough to where it's not holding him back. And it's giving him, he's still at a disadvantage, but man, he's at a disadvantage that allows him to win 56-20. So I'm proud of Dennis. Good shooting.
Well, alternate break 7-0 against a top player at the end of the tournament. That is just a remarkable score. Alternate the break 7-0. That means he got out probably every one of the breaks he broke, and then he got out every one of the breaks his opponent broke. Yeah. Probably, doesn't it? 7-0. I think that's
well,
what
I mean,
that means. Maybe a game of safety is in there somewhere, but pretty much that's it.
Yeah, it's hard at all. I'll tell you this, though. He didn't hang up any 10 balls.
Yeah,
no. No, he didn't. We know that for a fact.
Yeah. Is there anything
but
else?
Yeah, the break, we know it's big. Nate, you and I talk about that once in a while, and you get come
garbage.
Back from tournaments and you say, how did you do? Well, I wasn't breaking that good. So you didn't win. But when you do win, I guarantee you, you're breaking good whatever game you're playing. Maybe even, well, minus maybe One Pocket. The break's important, but it's not like as important, I don't think, as the rotation games and eight ball.
Yeah. My break is garbage. Definitely got to work on that. But with that, is there anything else we want to talk about for this topic, or do you want to move on?
I got one question for Demi, because he's played in professional events. And I noticed now the last year, they're especially in nine ball, they're not racking the one ball on the spot. They're racking the nine on the spot. And I see that, you know, in both cases, there's certain balls you can make on certain tables. It just seemed that way. Certain play, especially if a player's developed a way to make those shots. And my question for you, Demi, is out of those two ways to rack the ball, the nine on the spot or the one on the spot, what do you think is better? Which way is better competitively, and which way do you like the best?
Yeah, I think that racking, gosh, because there's more to it than just where you rack the balls. It's also, of course, you use a template, and then finally,
right, say a regular rack, a hand rack.
Well, okay, so then
a
with
wooden
a hand
rack or whatever.
So I'll tell you this: you can't really rack the one on the spot with a template, because if you do, the wing ball is going to be dead.
Even if
you're breaking from the box, I mean, you're just going to there's cut breaks. You can make the wing ball routinely, even with the three-point rule.
Last tournament.
Yeah. So that's the problem. Now, and even with the nine ball, the spot, it's a little bit less consistent. You can
then they
you
make
know,
the head ball on the side.
Well, the top player. I mean, Skyler. Boy, does Skyler have that breakdown? You know, he did really, really well at the U.S. Open and, you know, International Open about a year and a half ago, where he had just these huge multi-rack runs by cutting the one on the side and then playing shape on the two. So it can be done. But here's the problem. When we've seen that happen with that level of consistency, oftentimes it's been with a new set of polished balls on the AccuStats ring feature table that's all cleaned up. One thing that I was listening to a part of the last podcast, and you were talking about how the Derby pockets played a little soft, and I was like, yeah, I think that was the ring table. So the one that they put on the stream, you know, with the polished balls played pretty soft. But all the other tables of the place were all not vacuumed, and they had not balls that hadn't been polished for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days, and they were all playing tougher. And the reason that matters is because when you're breaking out a tough set of balls with clingy balls and dirty, you know, gritty tables, that nine ball on the spot, you can break the one on the side, you can still chip in the wing ball, but it's not 100%. And then the two variables, you have to get the 3-point rule, so you have to hit it hard, and the cue ball. you can't just control the cue ball quite as easily because you're playing the cue ball one rail through the rack area, and it can sweep into the balls and maybe carry them off the bottom of the nine and go to the foot rail. So I think out of all of them, I like the nine on the spot the best with the and if you use not a magic rack, if you just use a triangle rack with the nine on the spot, then it comes down to just I don't know. I mean, I don't have a way to – I haven't solved that break yet. So to with a triangle rack, I think you have to break them hard. And, yeah, you can get the corner ball going towards the corner. You can get stuff going towards the side. You can get stuff going towards the corner. And but trying to consistently make one and play shape on the next
ball. Well, it eliminates the automatic wing ball.
Yeah, it creates enough – it becomes a very difficult skill shot that's not as consistent. It's not as easy as just – sticking the wing ball in and playing shape on the one, which is what it used to be.
Yeah.
I still think that there's opportunity to make it more random and less, you know, but I don't know. For now, I think it's, if you're going to play nine ball at a professional level, then you're always going to have the break be a pivotal shot. So,
yep.
And then one shout out to Sergio Rivas. So this is the second tournament. He was out in hard times.
Sergio, yeah.
Yeah. We were talking about hard times. He was out there last week and now he's out here and he's out down here in Texas. So, you know, I don't know Sergio real well, but I mean, I've known him for, I don't know, if it's been 2 years or 5 years, probably 4 or 5 years I've known Sergio. And I'll tell you what, he's always been a good player. He's always, you know, gone to a tournament here and there, but it seems like he's kind of putting the gas pedal down. So I just, when I start seeing guys like Sergio and I start seeing their name pop up in California, then in Texas, my radar goes up and I'm like, ooh, this guy is taking a run at the title. And, he seems like he's really doing what he can to play everything he can play and expose himself to the highest levels and just take a shot at getting to be the best player he can be. And I really expect his game to skyrocket. And it wouldn't surprise me if you see, you know, I don't know if it'll be 6 months or if it'll be 3 years, but when somebody starts doing that, when somebody's the level Sergio is, they start doing what he's doing at the age he's doing it, it's pretty exciting for a U.S. pool, I'll just tell you that.
The advantage that Sergio has is his dad is very involved in his development and just goes with him, you know, practically everywhere, shares the load with him. And Jose, that's his dad, is a very good player in his own right, pocket pool player, has been for many, many years. But to have your parent, you know, behind you 100% of the way and urging you on to as far as you can go, that's a big deal. And I give, you know, I'll give a second shout out to Sergio's dad for that.
Very cool. Good info.
Yeah.
All right. So now we can move on to what's coming up. So there's only one big event going on this coming week, and that is a Francisco Bustamante and a Justin Bergman all-around matchup, or at least as it's being labeled. And this is an 8-ball, 1-pocket, and 10-ball all-around challenge, best 2 out of 3 sets. The 8-ball will be race to 25, take what you make, no jump cues. The 1-pocket is, well, I guess 1-pocket, race to 8. And then the deciding factor is going to be 10-ball, which it would be on Sunday if needed. So this will start Friday, the 21st, and finish the 23rd if the third set is needed. This should be a pretty fun matchup for us to talk about. So this is kind of a tough one to pick, right? Because I think the 10-ball goes to Justin pretty easily, I think, and the 1-pocket goes to Boosty pretty easily, I think. The 8-ball, the take what you make, race to 25, that kind of takes the break a little bit more out of play, but neither one of them have a huge break. I think Boosty breaks a little bit better, but what do you guys think about this one? It's kind of actually hard for me to pick, I think. I think I would ultimately go with Boosty as being the favorite here, but
well, I think we got to ask, does it say what, you know, is this a normal tournament diamond or is this one of those, are we playing back on Justin's draft table again?
Yeah. And it doesn't say it's Racks on the Rocks, I guess, is the name of the pool hall. So it's in West Peoria, Illinois.
Well, I'll tell you this much. If they were to get on a trap table with tight pockets, Francisco Bustamante is, if I had to vote for, I mean, other than exactly Dennis or Shaw, like Francisco Bustamante is not, he does not care if it's trap pockets. I watched him play a kind of a challenge match, or they call it an exhibition match or something like this, on a table that was so tight. This table was the tightest table in Minnesota. It had completely trapped shelves and gimmick pockets. And I mean, it was, I don't even play on this table. I haven't, you know, I find it to be an abomination. And he was playing and it was a little bit rough. And then he just kind of got settled in and smoothed out, and he started smoothing the balls and hitting the balls so pure that he was playing, you know, as good as most people can play on a bar table, on this table where he's shooting cross table from the kitchen, running balls down rails with, you know, running balls down the opposite side rail with speed and spin. And just, I mean, if you'd played on this table, you'd know you're not aiming at a pocket. You're aiming at a point. You know, there is a point in space that you're aiming that ball at. And he was shooting these things with distance, speed, and spin, and confidence, and just planing them into these, like, points in space that somehow the balls just kept going in. And I just attribute that to, I mean, he's just an amazing talent. And so, anyway, I just bring it up because I guess I'm less worried about the pocket size for Boosty. I don't really know what you could do. If your plan involves slowing this, if your plan involves letting Boosty to the table and thinking you're going to slow him down from running out, you're going to have a tough day. The only way to win against this guy is to simply put more racks together than he can. So I like your pick. I'm also a little disappointed. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, incentives and reward, you know, what we're doing to promote good matches. And, you know, with what we talked about with the pace of play on the last matchup and stuff, I think it's strange that they've got as much negative feedback as they got about how long that match took and the pace of play. And that not only, so now it's like a double whammy where I think that they didn't fix the problem, and they didn't really, like, they never really acknowledged the problem. They didn't apologize for a problem. They didn't do anything to fix the problem. And they didn't even, you know, they didn't even mention that they received feedback, and now they're putting Bergman back in the ring a week or two later in a format playing games that are even more moving games, like eight ball in one pocket. I just, am I wrong to feel like that's kind of a middle finger to the fans? Like, what, like, yeah, we aren't going to even acknowledge the feedback we got. We're not going to change anything. We're not going to elicit anything. And now we're going to have Bergman playing eight ball in one pocket. Isn't, like, how do you take that? Isn't that kind of a dismissive?
Well, it kind of depends on the pace of play, right? Because you could ignore something as being a problem and still address it in the future, right? So I'm sure Bergman realizes some of the criticism that he got for his slow play.
So now we've got two bets. Who's going to win?
Is, yes, there, of course.
The average? So, I mean, do you really think, but I'll tell you what, let me ask you this question. And I'm sorry to cut step on you, but if they had done something to address the pace of play with Bergman, they already know, they've been told by so many people saying that they aren't going to watch ever again, or they're not going to watch Bergman play. Why would they not have then said, hey, we've heard your feedback. You're very right. We're sorry for the people that did this. Here's what we're doing to fix the problem. We've done A, B, or C to kind of speed things up. And, you know, as a sign of goodwill, anybody that watched the last one, we'll give you guys, you know, 20% towards this one, just as a, you know, as a gesture of good faith. Because if you couldn't watch it all, give us a chance to show you that we fixed it. We made it right. Like, I don't know, man. What would be the marketing strategy behind keeping it a tight-lipped secret that they fixed the problem?
Well, I don't think that's possible, just because the streaming services for this one is different. This is Pool Action TV, so I mean, they could probably care less about what the previous streamers had done.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know what? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and that's but in an ideal world, yes, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt or the benefit of the uncertainty. With that being said, I'm not buying this. I'm not going to. You know, if I see on Facebook that, hey, all these things were addressed, then I will continue to support Justin Bergman streams. I still think Justin Bergman is such a talent to watch. He's such a treat to be able to watch and to watch how he plays and how he picks apart racks. And I love watching Justin Bergman play. It's just, I only like watching him play for four racks because after that I'm ready to just put a bullet in my head because it's just so slow. I would love to be able to watch more of it. I really would. It's so hard. You literally cannot do anything else while watching him play because he only shoots the ball once every 45 seconds. So if you miss him shoot one ball, you have to wait another, you know, almost a minute it's not worth it to me personally. I mean, other people, if they want to do that, that's their prerogative. Great. But with that being said, I love watching Justin Bergman play. So if this is fixed, I'm going to be the first person to jump right back on board. I just need to see an actual track record of it happening before I'm going to support my money for it again.
So and I think that's – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
You'd like to watch Justin run 100 balls against you then in the straight pool, I bet.
Well, I mean I would love to watch him play. I mean,
do that?
anything that he could do – anything that he does on a pool table, I love to watch. I can't do the 45 to 1 minute innings at one ball on the table. It's just too much. And the getting up and getting down, he gets down on a shot and then stands back up two more times, and it's just like, it's draining as a viewer. It is. And it's sad.
That's why I brought it up. But you know what? I don't regret it because I do think it's fair. There's been so many people that have said that I don't think it's fair not to talk about that because I think it's a little shocking there's not more to be done to prevent that from being an issue. But that being said, I don't want to focus on the glass that's half full, which that is definitely, I mean, the half empty, that's definitely the half empty. But the half full is this. This is one of the more interesting matchups that we've seen.
Oh, it is.
I think it's a great matchup. I don't know that it's entirely clear. I actually think that I'm probably going to get a bet in on Boosty. And I think that you say that playing 10 ball, that Bergman is going to win the 10 ball set. I'm not so sure. I think that that's more up in the air because Boosty, okay, let's take a look at it from a few different things. I mean, he did really well on the Bigfoot at Derby playing 10 ball, you know, Boosty did. I mean, I know he, you know, whatever, missed a ball on the hill rack against Shaw, but not many people were going hill with Shaw, and that was on a 10-footer, right? So, and their Fargo rates are similar. So Boosty's level of game is pretty high. And so then you say, well, what about gambling experience and match experience? And, you know, Bergman's a great match player, but Boosty, he doesn't really, I don't really think he's intimidated. I mean, he's not the kind of guy that
not
can
at
intimidated.
All.
So it's like Justin Bergman read the book. Francisco Bustamante wrote the book on gambling.
Yeah, there you go. So I mean, I don't know. I mean, if they played just 10 ball, I mean, that's a tough match, man. I don't even know if I'd pick Berg. I mean, maybe, but if you pick Bergman, I'll put it this way: if you pick Bergman in the 10 ball, then he might have a slight pull. But it's not decisive. Like, I wouldn't say that Boosty can't win the tiebreaker, especially if, let's just say that Boosty wins the one pocket and then he gets clipped nearly in the eight ball. Like, you can't say that it's not within the realm of possibility for Boosty just to come out of the gate and put the hammer down, you know, playing 10 ball. And so, but meanwhile, it is very possible that, I mean, and of course, you know, Bergman can win the one pocket. So, and Bergman can win the eight ball. So I think they're both live in all three events. But so the question is, who's the favorite in each of the events, and then by what margin? So maybe we say, let's say Boosty's the favorite in the one pocket. Let's give Bergman credit for being the favorite in the 10 ball. I think with the eight ball, this one's a tough one, but I got to go Boosty in the eight ball. And I say it's tough because Bergman, you know, he's played on a lot of eight ball in his life, but eight ball is the kind of game where there's a lot of weird, uncomfortable situations that come up with you know, creative safety play and a creative shot making where you have to break open clusters. And here's the thing I'd say about 8-ball. There's a lot of situations that come up that you can't plan and you can't control. Like, you know, like firing at a difficult back cut and swinging the cue ball into a cluster and trying to use the right speed and finesse to not only break open the shot, but get a shot at it and, you know, maybe even get a good angle to get on the next ball. Like, you can't control all that. There's so many things in 9-ball and rotation seems like a control game. You're always controlling things. Whereas in 8-ball, there's so many times that you just have to flow and gin shots. You just have to hit them just right to get the cue ball to carry them into the right part of the cluster. And I think with 10-ball and a tight table where it's like all of a control game, I mean, Bergman does really, really well. I'm not saying he can't play good 8-ball, but I'm saying Boosty is kind of a rotation player, like a full rack rotation Filipino. Like, I think he's going to flow with that 8-ball real, real well. And I just see him kind of finessing stuff and kind of massaging stuff and just flowing with stuff. So I think I give Boosty an edge in the 8-ball and the one pocket. I think I get Bergman the edge in the 10-ball just because you have to say somebody, but I think it's really close. And so my take on it is that nobody's decisive in any of the three. The one pocket would be the most decisive, but it's only a race to 8. So the one pocket's only a race to 8. So it's really, really hard to say he's that decisive. But I mean, if I had to, like, say percentage wise, let's just say I say that Boosty is, like, you know, I don't know, 65, you know, is he 60? Let's just call it 60% or 65% of the one pocket. He might be 55% of the 8-ball and he might be 50% of the 10-ball. So I just feel like the guy's as good or better in all three categories. And I don't know, man, maybe if anybody has an edge in anything, if Bergman has an edge in anything, like you said, he might have. But maybe I'm missing something. You know, maybe Bergman is such a straight shooter that he's actually got the edge in 8-ball too, because it's a shooting game and Bergman's just going to outshoot Boosty. But I've been watching Boosty play. I mean, shoot, I played him at Derby. I've been watching him play. I've seen him play a lot in the last year. And would you guys agree? Do you think in the last 2 years, don't you think Boosty's been playing about as good as he's ever played in his life?
Yeah, I don't know. He's had some pretty good years.
What did he do? I've always liked him. At the Derby in 2019.
He's one of my favorite players.
In 2019 at Derby, did he win the all around, or did he just win the one pocket?
Sky won the all around.
That's right. Boosty won the one pocket, right?
Boosty won the one pocket, yes. And then he finished high in the banks too.
I don't know, man. I think if you're going to bet on Bergman, you've got to have like a reason. Like, is he going to shoot better? Is he going to have more heart? Is he going to have more confidence? Like, what exactly are you betting on with Bergman? And the only thing, I don't think you can give Bergman like, you know, confidence or heart or gambling experience. Like, you can't really give him an edge in that category. Not that he's not great, but just, you're talking about Boosty here. I think the only area that you could say that he's got an edge is, I mean, if you just think that ultimately he's just shoots straighter, more consistent.
What are their numbers, Nate?
They're very close to the same.
Yeah, Francisco's a 789 Fargo. Bergman's a 790. And so here's the thing. You could say the only thing I think you could say is that maybe it's a stamina thing. You know, like, but I mean, they're playing a race to 8. Race to 8, one pocket. Boosty can handle that. Race to 25, 8-ball. So, like, maybe you could say that. Maybe that's what you're betting on. Maybe you're betting that Boosty wears down and falls apart. But here's what I've seen. I'll tell you what I've seen is that the style of play that Boosty plays is not like Bergman. He's not so controlling and tight that come midnight he's going to fall apart. He seems pretty loose and relaxed, and that what happens as you get towards midnight, he doesn't tighten up and start getting fatigued and missing. He just hits this freewheel stroke where his arm's just like oil, and he's probably going to make more unforced errors than Bergman, or like what seems like careless mistakes, and those can add up. But I'll tell you, man, he can also flow through so many racks that I think if one of those two guys wears out, it might be the guy that's taking 40 practice strokes. So I don't know, man. I the more I talk about it,
there is that factor, isn't there?
Yeah, this looking, they're both live. Bergman's obviously a great player, a great grinder, and what he did to Mora. Anybody that thinks that Bergman can't win against anybody, I mean, Bergman's Pete Shaw for the cash. Wasn't the top Shaw that we saw today, but apparently he's playing good enough to where, you know, Shaw didn't like the color of the curtains in the pool hall last year, and he ducked out of there. So, I mean, obviously Bergman or whatever it was. So, but Bergman really? Obviously playing great. But the bottom line is that I the more I think about it, I think I got to get a little bet in on Boosty.
Yeah, I'm going with the Boosty.
Yeah, I would go with Boosty too. I agree with your kind of your breakdown. I think I would say Boosty is probably 65% in the one pocket. I think 8-ball, they're probably pretty close to even, actually. 55-45 Boosty, and then I would probably go probably 40% Boosty in the 10-ball. I don't think it's closer. I don't think it's as close as you necessarily say it is for the 10-ball, but you know, that's the only thing that I really disagree with there. And when you have a 55% favorite and a 65% favorite, I think you got to take that. So I think Boosty wins it too. But
yeah, the only thing I'd say about the 10 ball is that their Fargo rates are within 1 point, right? And so what is it that you well, let me ask you this. What is it that you think Bergman does better that makes him a favorite in 10 ball?
Well, and it kind of depends on the table size, right? Like you said, if it's super tight tables, I do think that Bergman at this point in his career is a little bit better of a cueist at just moving around in a 10-ball rotation rack than Boosty would be. He doesn't make a lot of mistakes walking around the table.
Yeah, that makes sense. He's really dialed into a grindy, perfectionist kind of game. And yep. So guys that want to flow... And like I said, I've seen Boosty do things on tight tables that have made my jaw drop so often that I don't consider that a prohibitive, but I can see why that would make an impact on the match. Yeah.
Yeah. So, we're all in agreement on Boosty in this one.
Wow.
And that all being said, I want to be clear because I'm not just trying to hedge my bets or save face, but when I say Boosty, I mean, as an overall, I mean, I might think that Boosty's a 60% favorite, but that doesn't mean that Bergman can't win. It just means that if I had to bet, I'd bet Boosty.
Yeah, and we're picking small edges. We're picking small edges here. I mean,
small edges here. We're not saying like
the match wouldn't happen if the match wouldn't happen if it was a 95-5 favorite, right? So we're picking who we think is on small edges.
Yep, and I just want to make it clear to people that are listening. It sounds like we're like, oh, yeah, Boosty's going to win this. It's like, no, what we're saying is we think that Boosty has an advantage, but there's a reason. I mean, that's why the cards have backs.
Yep. Yep, for sure. So I guess with that, we can move on. Let's pick up where we left off. So for a discussion topic this week, Rob is a little bit fired up with some of the Fargo events that have been happening around Wisconsin and maybe... Well, I'll ask you this afterwards, Demetrius, whether or not it's in Minnesota as well. But a lot of the events around Wisconsin delegate out players like Rob and I. And I am a 660-ish Fargo. Rob, you're like a 650, right? Something like that. So a lot of the events in Wisconsin, at least, are getting to the point now where they're all some number Fargo, 550, 525, 450, 500, you know, every now and then you'll see a 600 event, and about two or three times a year, you'll have a 650-ish and under Fargo event. And then you sprinkle in about one open tournament per month somewhere in the state. And that's kind of the pool scene in Wisconsin right now. And Rob, you wanted to talk about whether or not that in the long run, whether or not we think that that is going to be good to promote, not pool in general, but to promote getting better at the game of pool and actually wanting to get better at pool. Because what's the point of getting better if you're just going to get delegated out of the tournaments that have helped you get better?
People use the system. I mean, I know people that go to events and play in events that are only team events that aren't entered into Fargo. And so their number, and even if... They use the number to do like a three-person team, like a 16, 50 and under, or 1800 and under for three-person, or five-person team under a certain number, that they won't go to events where that their number will change. They'll only play in the team events. So their number always stays low. So now they're taking this Fargo number system that's supposed to benefit everybody, you know, how everybody shoots. You're going to play somebody, and I'm not going to play an 800 unless I get spotted, the world, you know. And it's all nice and dandy for that. But the other aspect of competitive pool kind of loses its taste. We we kind of get, well, gee, you and I can't go. We have to go. We have to go play in a tournament where there's 650s and higher. Well, okay.
Which is fine, I should say.
Do I want to go drive 3 hours there, 3 hours back?
And that's exactly what it is.
Spend $400 and hope I come in fourth or fifth and break even.
And that's exactly what it is for me. Is I'm okay with playing better players. I have no problem with that. I just don't want to have to drive 3 hours once a month to be able to do it. I would like to be able to drive, you know, a normal distance, a half hour to an hour, like all of these other events, to be able to do that. I'm okay with that.
So, yeah, it's a mess, man. What I think one of the problems, I mean, when I – well, okay. So when I grew up, of course, and I was playing pool, the if you were a fish and you couldn't – you know, you couldn't run three balls, then you lost. And then what you'd do is you'd get in the ring with people and you'd lose and you'd pay your dues and you'd lose money matches and play sets with people and go through a growing period until finally you got good enough to where now – you know, here's where the bar is. Here's where the players that are beating me play. What do I have to do to figure out how to beat them? And then you put your game together or put in years of work and play, and then you got to where you could beat them, and then you were the person that could win. And there was a payoff. There was a payoff for being kind of the best in your area, because then you'd be the one winning, and you'd be kind of the, you know, it was kind of like playing King of the Hill. You know, the game when you play with your kids, my kids were just talking about this, where, you know, you have a little hill, everybody's trying to get to the top of the hill, whoever's at the top is king of the hill, everyone's trying to pull them down. Basically, pool in the local pool rooms was like a game of King of the Hill. Everyone's trying to get to the top, and there was a payoff for being at the top, because what would happen is there'd be a few guys that would be kind of the local town heroes, where they would take turns winning the tournaments, and they're winning money, and they're playing gambling matches, and people are ringed around watching them, and they're walking around the pool room like celebrities, and they're kind of a big deal. And so there was a hierarchy that had a payoff for advancement. And that payoff was a little bit financial, but not that much, but a little. And then it was also, you know, respect and status and all these things. And so what this has changed is that with the Fargo rate separated tournaments, is that it's not only changed the payouts financially, but between that and the fact that these days, if somebody wants to watch a top pool player, they don't have to go down to their local pool room and watch, you know, the local house pro. In fact, that guy, why would they even bother watching him? I could go on YouTube and watch the best of the world. So there's a lot of changes that have led to the fact that top players right now are not rewarded or esteemed the way they were. And I'm not just complaining about that, like, oh, well, I'm a top player, I want respect. It's not that. It's a matter of, what if you remove the payouts for the good players, then it changes the incentives. And so then what is driving people to get better? There's only one thing driving people to improve, and that's those people that are actually, you know, intrinsically motivated for, you know, self-growth and development. So it's a weird change, but I think a big part of that is you look at what are the payouts for the top players, and if the payouts for being the strongest player in your division are greater than the payouts for improving, then that kind of puts people in a weird spot, right?
Yeah. And, you know, what's happening, too, you see a general decline in tournaments that don't have a ceiling on the Fargo. They're just declining. You know, the open events, the open tournaments. You know, they're going from the open team tournaments, you see, and where it used to be 20, 25 teams, three-man teams in an open division, now are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 teams. And that's happening in Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, because of that.
Yeah, and the
same thing, you're almost better off saying, you know, let's allow one player over a certain number to play on your team, or two, or you know what I'm saying?
Well, but then here's the problem. You know, we always have to ask which is the chicken, which is the egg. Like, are these tournament directors and league promoters that are looking at the landscape of players and saying, you know what, we think that the lion's share of the players are in this, you know, I mean, let's face it, you know, 99.9% of the players are under 700. 99% of the players are under 650. So then it's like they look at that. It's like, so then here's the thing. They are just bringing a product to market. Ultimately, their tournaments are just a product that they're bringing to market. And if there's 10,000 times more players that will buy product B than product A, then you are you if there's the demand, can you blame the people that supply to that demand? And
can't
I think that so you can't blame players for wanting their chance to win and be competitive.
Nope.
And you can't blame tournament directors for giving them the opportunity that these players want, which is basically a fast road to being competitive or whatever. And so the question is, do we like it? Do we wish it was different? Yes.
Well,
I mean,
actually,
do we wish that people,
if I can jump in, this is kind of where I knew the discussion would end up getting to, which is why I originally stated the question as, do we think that this is going to be good for actually getting better at the game?
No.
Yeah. Well,
so in the end, my point is that there's another question, which is it going to change? Is there anything anybody could do about it? And I think that tournament directors are at the mercy of supplying to what the pool players want. I think that human nature, I think that there are people that want to get better as purists. There are people that want to play recreationally and don't care if they get better. And then there's a few people that actually want to game the system and try to remain in the right bucket, like Rob was saying, to take advantage of the system. And so to me, in the past, I traditionally don't really care what anybody else does. I just want to get better, and I respect the people that are trying to improve. But in the end, players are going to do what they're going to do. Tournament directors are going to bring this product to market to respond to that. Nothing anybody could do is going to change that. The only thing that I see that might be an improvement and something that I actually kind of look forward to, I think that league play. So the question is, what is the path from somebody from 500 to 800? And so it's really, really murky, because what happens is league play and regional tournaments they provide a path to the 600s, right? And then when you get to like the 780 to 800 range, then Matchroom provides a path to 820. Okay. So there's a place for you if you're 770, and there's a place for you if you're 570. But where do you connect the 600 to the 750 or 800s? And there's a kind of a gap in the middle. And I really feel like one thing that I hope, so then you look at it, it's like, well, there's Sergio Rivas, where you've got a guy who's just traveled around the country. He's grown beyond his local tournament setup, but he can't win at the international level. So he's just going to travel around and just kind of donate for 5 or 10 years. Hopefully, you know, someday either he could get paid off because he gets to the highest levels of pool, or most likely he doesn't. He stays broke. He doesn't get there, but he has a good memory. And try, and it gets to say he tried. And so I think that the problem is that there's a gap between, there's not only is there not a payoff for being a top local player, but there's just the road kind of evaporates from between 650 and 750 or 800. And I think that, so anyway, I hope that leagues and maybe Matchroom, like, what if, I'm just trying to think of a possibility of how that could be solved and how all of this could be solved. And if Matchroom got involved with, like, say, APA leagues, to where players that did well in local leagues got to play in more like national tournaments and stuff like that. And then some of those guys got swept into the, you know, is there a solution? Is it possible that this could ever be solved? Let me ask you guys that.
I had ran a pool hall here in Marshfield for about 8 years. And in league play, I found that everybody played together in the same league. I had singles leagues, right? And I developed my own numbers. I didn't have Fargo numbers. I had numbers that went a little lower and a little higher. And I adjusted those numbers weekly. And we played by points, 8 ball, 10 points a ball, 45 points for winning the game. I did weight the game a little bit more than some people do, winning or losing the game. And what I found was that the highest number in the league was 1,050. And the lowest number in the league was 275. And those two players got together and played, you know, twice a season, with half a year seasons. And that usually at the end of the game that was separated by probably no more than 20 or 30 points, one way or the other, where the 10-50 losing one time and the 275 losing the other time. So very, very, very close. And what I found was that ordinarily somebody who was going to lose 7, 8, 9 games out of 9 games isn't going to really have any fun and want to do that or even pay attention to maybe get better. But what I found in the league setting, not a tournament setting, but league setting, was that they did respond to that. They didn't just sit there and go, okay, another rack run and not really pay attention. That they were paying attention because they knew that even at a 275, they actually had a chance to win a match against the best player in this league, who was over 1,000. And we didn't have to adjust time settings or anything else like that. Most of the players in the league were like a 550, 650, 750, someplace in that. Now, my numbers aren't anything like Fargo. But because Fargo isn't based on point scoring in 8-ball. I don't know what it's based on. 8-9 pages of high-end math that I don't know if even Nate can understand.
I've seen the algorithm. I can understand it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, you can understand it, yes.
But that's okay. So, but there's two different things. So I'm not disagreeing that it's possible to set up a handicap system that accomplishes a couple goals that keeps the you know, this is, I think, what everyone originally wanted. Okay. What people originally wanted with handicapping was we would like to close the gap between the players that are at the top and the players that are at the bottom. We want to close that gap so that more people turn out because they actually are live. So even though they have a disadvantage, they have less of a disadvantage. And so then they'll show up and then they'll be rewarded occasionally if they play at their highest level or get a good, you know,
exactly.
Match.
Exactly.
But at the same time, there's still an incentive to move up the hierarchy because the players at the top are still winning more consistently.
Yeah.
So that okay, but that was the original. Okay, so that was the original goal. But then the question is, you know, so we talk about player incentives. What are the incentives for the players? But what about the tournament director? So originally it was let's close the gap and blah, blah, blah. But what if they found out that actually, if instead of closing the gap, what if we eliminate the gap? Or what if we just forget about the top 5% or top 0.5% and focus on giving the other 99% what they really want? So now the first question was what was the incentive for the players to get better? But now the question is what is the incentive for the tournament director to even try to preserve that type of hierarchy in the advancement of the game? Yeah, it's best for the advancement of the pool game or, you know, the local skill levels. But if he could fill up his tournaments and make more people come into a pool hall and sell more drinks and add more money and have more fees or whatever, like if people are going to respond more. So in other words, they don't like open tournaments. People don't show up often enough. They like the handicap tournaments, they show up a little bit more. But if we over-handicap them and eliminate the top players and just raffle off prize money to everybody in the
Everybody shows up then.
Everybody shows up. So ultimately, what's the – like, I know that it can be done the way you're saying it. Like you're saying, hey, what you're just saying, Rob, is that you could come up with a good handicapping system that rewards top players while encouraging other players to improve and participate. And
oh, yeah.
That's true.
Well, on top of that.
But that's a,
on
why
top
would
of
they
that,
even do that?
If you don't want me jumping in there, Rob, your system was fine, and there's nothing wrong with it. But the Fargo rated system can be used in the same exact way that you used yours. There's no difference between them. The tournament directors just refuse to use 100% handicap when they do their Fargo events. They either want to run apparently open tournaments or to cap tournaments. The Fargo system is not being used to its capacity. The Fargo system could be used in the same exact way yours
is. Also, you can't. I find it hard to apply a numbering system to a win-loss game system with no numbers involved in it.
Yeah, but
you know,
if
you stick to points, like 115 points to win a game, you know, then you can add those points up and you play to whatever your number is.
Yeah.
If you can't transpose that into game wins or losses, then it doesn't make any sense to even have the numbers.
Well, we've had this discussion before, and Mike Page
yeah,
is actually Mike Page has actually done a lot of research on this when it comes to Is there a huge difference between the system that you run and the system that Fargo Rate runs as far as over the long run? Will they deviate from each other? And Mike Page found that the difference between the data is it's very, very small.
I have no doubt about
that. The systems run almost identical.
We're talking about different things. One, because
we kind of are.
So here's let's just say there's one question, which is how should pool be rated handicapped, and how can pool skill be measured at handicap? That's one question. Another question is, to what level should we handicap tournaments, and should we exclude people, or should we just wait it, or should we make it an all-out lottery where everybody just shows up and then raffles off the prize money randomly because that's a true handicapping system? But then the last question is, what do we actually anticipate as playing out in the future? And, this is the way that things are, good or bad. What's the path forward from where we're at? And is there anything that anybody can do? There's just different questions to be answered. So, I would think that the bottom line is that bickering over handicap system. I mean, Rob, I believe your system worked well. I know Fargo Rate works extremely well. And this is here, and it's not – I mean, Fargo Rate's here is not going away. As far as how it gets used, like we said, it would be really, really nice if the tournament directors would weight things to still favor the top players to where they could participate, be rewarded, and encourage improvement. But we also understand that they are responding to the market, which is the 99% that are saying, let's just kick all the pros, let's kick all the quote-unquote master players out, and then we'll just have our own world championships where we all have our chance of being the world champion. Yeah, and in the end, the question is, what can be done about it? And the idea is that what is the road for the players that have invested, years and years into the game to get to 650 or 700 or whatever level? And the idea being that if there's not some kind of payoff, reward, or path for those players, then what's your incentive for the weaker players? And the answer, is there's going to be no path for our 650, 7, and 750 Fargo Rate players if there's not money flowing into that game. So either there's got to be dead money, there's either got to be open tournaments with 80% of the field that can't win, paying up entries for the opportunity to grow and experience. There's got to be money flowing into the game in the form of dead money, either from other entry fees, from sponsors, from added money from pool halls. And so what we've done is we've eliminated the dead money because they're going to play in their own divisions. So yeah, the 650 and 750s can play in their own divisions. They're going to have five people show up. That's great. There's not any dead money flowing in. Meanwhile, there's not any added money because, let's face it, our 700 players aren't the draw that they used to be at pool halls. It's not like somebody with a 700 Fargo is going to show up and they're going to pack the pool hall because people want to watch them play because now they can watch Federer Gorst on YouTube. So they can't really bring in players and sell seats. They're not good enough to sell seats. They don't have dead money flowing into the game from dead entry fees. So how there's not even a way that they can really – the 700 Fargo rates – they're kind of in a no man's land. And unless they find a way to bring money into their division, how do the really that's what has to happen is the 700 Fargo Rate wants to compete. They've got to find a way to bring money into their division. And, actually, as I think about the listeners and stuff, I don't even know, how much it'll strike them because most players aren't really going to fall into that range. Most players are probably going to say, well, I'm never going to get to that level. So really, as long as I have a place to play, that's great for me. But I don't think this affects the majority of the pool population. I think there's a very, very, very few people that land in this category, and that for overall, I think it's probably a good thing for pool to have handicap tournaments and divisions and give everybody a chance to compete. I think leagues was a really great place because it allowed all levels of players to compete, but it still had opportunity for the top level players. But I guess what are your thoughts, guys?
Well, even the leagues now, I agree that the leagues were kind of that way, but even now, a lot of the leagues that I see now are even handicapped, or they're, you can only have a team with this high of a Fargo or, stuff like that. So even the leagues now are kind of falling into this category of neutralizing, giving everybody a chance to win. And, I definitely don't agree with that. I think leagues, whether you want to play with your buddies or whether you want to try and stack up the best team in your area and just dominate everybody, it's league. It's a week to get out, and it's a week to pick up your, it's an opportunity to pick up your pool cues and try and stay in stroke during the week for the tournaments on the weekend. It's really not that big of a deal. I think they should just be open, but this is coming from somebody, I guess, that's on a quote-unquote stacked team. So
we in our league, of course, over the years living in a small town, we have a blood-loaded team, a classic. There's three teams in a town of 40 teams that are pretty loaded. And we put up with years and years of people griping that we were, you know, every other year, almost every year, we were winning the city championship, and all we cared about was the money. So last year what we did was we broke off from the other 40 teams, and there were eight teams that came, and they were the eight best teams, you could say, in the city. And to make a point, we had a league, and we played league this year with no money in it. There was no winning. If you won the league, you won the league. You didn't win a trophy. You didn't win a plaque. You won nothing. You just ended up in first. We didn't pay any money to have league when we went. It was free. So we had no fees. And the bars just put the money in the tables.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell you what.
Because we'd had enough of the other, you know, you guys. And it was just, yeah, we're good players, but we're all friends. We just happened to be playing on the same team together.
Yeah, good player. You know, good players. If you're a good player, you've been around the game for a long time. You've been around a lot of other players who've been around the game a long time, and they tend to be good players too. So you happen to become friends with the people that you've been playing with for 20 years to get good. That's kind of how it works. It's not always people trying to rob. It's those are the friends that you tend to make because you've been around them the most.
And that's the point we were going to make. We don't care about the money. Yeah. We don't care. We happen to win, but we don't care.
And Rob, let me respond to that, because here's the thing: I don't play pool for the money of playing pool either. So, you know, as broken as things are, you know, it's easy to look at how things used to be and then look at how things are evolving and just notice that the negative changes are negative, you know, notice that there's some things like, oh, well, top players can't participate. They're not getting rewarded. Everything's broken down. But here's the fact. So there's only a couple reasons people want to be better at pool. They either want the, you know, some people are doing it for money, some people are doing it for recognition, but mostly it's for the satisfaction of achieving a goal, right?
Absolutely.
And so when you look at it, like for me, I don't know if I mentioned this, but in 2019 I only played one tournament in Minnesota, one tournament in my own home state in the entire year, and the rest of the time I was traveling around playing regional or national events because of this, because it's like, well, either it's so handicapped I can't play, or just I'm not welcome. But that's okay.
There's always that not welcome thing, isn't there?
But that's okay, because here's the way I look at it.
Oh, guess who showed up this tournament?
Well, so listen, I don't need, it's like, let's just take money off the table, because with pool money so small, it's, you know, let's just take that off the table. And when it comes to like the satisfaction of winning a tournament, it's like, well, I don't have to go around and win these tournaments against these players to prove anything to myself, because the positive of Fargo rate is that I can sit there and look at my Fargo rate and be like, well, look at that. That's where I rank, you know, in Minnesota or in the country or whatever. And so therefore, instead of having to go here and play these tournaments and win against these players and prove something, I don't have anything to prove to these guys. I can go play with the pro players, finish how I finish, and then the fact is, even if I don't play a single tournament in Minnesota, I know where I stand. You know what I mean? And so it's like, I don't know. I feel like everything's okay. Like, I don't need to do this for the money. I'm not missing out on my chance to win, because I kind of automatically win just based on having reached the skill level I've reached. And as far as players setting and achieving goals, I think Fargo Rate's really, really positive, because they can say, hey, here's exactly where I play. And so, listen, 95
to aim for. You have a number to aim for.
So 95% of players are recreational and aren't even trying to get better. And then you've got like 5% that are actually trying to get better, and they have something that they can see and challenge themselves and try to do better. And it's very, very clear. And I think that there's a lot of positives about Fargo Rate as far as helping the game and encouraging people to strive. And so basically what I think I'm saying is this. It was almost like, suppose you were playing pool, and instead of having whoever won the match win the match, suppose you had a panel of judges just watching how players struck balls and voting with a number sign, you know, 9.3 or 8.7, and just rating the players based on how they evaluated their play, like if it was a judge's decision. Well, it would be interesting. You'd be like, well, I'm used to it being whoever wins and loses, and now it's coming down to judges' decision. But it should still be, the results should still be there. And I guess what I'm saying is I'm used to, you know, kind of measuring your skill. 5 years ago, you'd measure where you stood in the pecking order with gambling matches and tournament wins. But now you could just kind of Fargo rate's kind of like judges' decision. You could just kind of go play your pool where you play your pool, and then you don't have to necessarily compete in local tournaments to prove where you stand. You just play where you play where you play. Most people, trickles back to Fargo, and then you just kind of have a working level of play that you've established that kind of becomes the judge's decision on your overall skill level. And I think that's a really big positive. I think it's just a little different. It's like, yeah, I might not get to play a bunch of local tournaments and just go beat up on people and be like, look at me. But that doesn't take away my opportunity to go play, go compete, and have a measuring stick of how I'm doing.
That's a good way of looking at it. And I think we can use that to wrap this discussion up with, since it's gone pretty long.
Yeah.
So we can close out with some tips really quick. So Rob, do you want to go first on your tip?
I'll give a tip on breaking. It's never been my best suit, breaking, but I have noticed, messing around with it, that if you have a good rhythm to your, like a beat, like a musical beat or a rhythm to your breaking stroke, that seems to help with timing and the amount of force you're putting into the cue ball and hitting the cue ball, you know, by and large, in the center, pretty much the center of the ball, and just with a, you know, a good, what is it, 1.7 or 8 seconds kill stroke,
yeah.
Maybe even on break, maybe even 2 seconds.
Yeah,
as
long as it's consistent. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, but some kind of rhythm with your break, you know.
Yep, I can go next, and mine is going to be more or less a broad general statement, is don't be a high roller. I've already told you two the stories in much more detail, but I promise you that if you think you're that cool guy that shows up to the pool hall and wants to gamble for $1,000 and knows that nobody around you can be that person that fronts $1,000, you don't look cool. You literally just look like a bully, like a schoolyard bully. I've had a situation twice now where this person shows up to the college and actually wants to gamble college students $1,000. And I actually called him out twice on it and put the money on the table. And he backed down remarkably quickly. And it was cute to watch how quick he didn't want to play for that amount of money anymore once he found out somebody could actually do it. So don't be a high roller. It's just cheeky, and it's like the dumbest thing that you can do. And we all know that one person that does it, and it's, nobody looks at him favorably or her. So that's my advice. Don't be a high roller.
Yeah, there was a great comeback somebody used. There was these two guys that were kind of talking about a game, and player A said something about, well, let's just play a set for $5,000. And player B just said, so what you're saying is you don't want to play. like what you're really saying is you don't want to play, man, huh? So it's just kind of funny because it's like, once you think about it, it's obvious that that's what they're saying. It's like, let's just throw out a number so big that you can't match it. And then it makes it seem like I'm the, you know, the badass here. And it's like, no, what you're really saying is you don't want to play. Yeah, my tip will be really, really easy. I'm just going to say the most important word in pool is next. So whether you get a bad roll, whether you miss a shot, whether your opponent gets a good roll, whatever just happened that you're not happy with or that you wish you could do over or that whatever, it's gone. Next, just go on to the next. And if you get good at next, then you will have a huge advantage over people that haven't mastered that word. It's 4 letters. If we want, we can look up the dictionary definition. But anyway, I just say, just
have
use that
memory.
It's your secret weapon. Next, most important word in pool.
Yep, I agree. So I will.
I agree too with that.
Yep, we can wrap it up there, and I will thank a sponsor today, Tom Cox and Maria Juana. They don't listen to the podcast, but they are sponsors to the podcast, so that's fun. They own the local pool room in Madison, or Sun Prairie, I should say, the Rock Sports Bar and Grill. So if you are a listener in the Madison area, head over there and support their pool hall for supporting the podcast. And with that, we can close it out for another week. Demetrius, Rob, thanks again for joining me.
Nate, thanks. See you next time. Demi, see you next time. Thanks a lot.
Have a great week, guys. Hit them good.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Cue Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindum for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T.